It's a disputed border between China and Russia. Always will be disputed. Right. Keeps those two guys busy. Keeps them out of our hair, I guess. So you look for fishes of high tolerance to your water system. You make an array of fish which eat different things, some of which may not be present in your pond. Obviously, if you're getting a high pH, you're going to have hardly any mollusks. And if you're getting, if you've got a weed-free pond, you're not going to bother with grass-eating fish. And then you select, in that group of fish, the grass eaters, you can select, or vegetation eaters, or diatomeas, you can select three or four species of fish which live in different parts of the pond, don't interfere with each other. So it's, there's a three-way choice system there, which is quite enough to puzzle you for quite a while. What you actually end up with is between three and six fish species chosen for your location. And you don't go past that because there's a point at which more complexity doesn't give you any more yield, you know, and it's usually about six species. It starts to level off, you know. If you add 26 species, your yield doesn't increase that much. So in terms of total yield, maybe somewhere between three to six species of fish, and that's excluding other organisms which they may tolerate. Like a lot of those fish can be grown with prawns, or all of them can be grown with mussels, except the mussel-eating fish. Right. So then in the vertebrates, there's a whole lot of water-associated mammals, one of the more important of which will probably be the capybara and the nutria also. The capybara is a very large rodent, actually. It's so large you can ride on it. It's about that long and travels in families, squeaking companionably to each other in giant marshes of the pampas, and they're very efficient food converters, say compared to beef. Locally they're also preferred to beef, and it may very well be they'll be farming these guys in the natural marshes of South America, and they're very efficient food converters. And in the nutria, which is also fairly widely used for food and is still quite a large rodent, has an excellent fur. Nobody wears capybara, a lot of people wear nutria. It's been widely introduced in cold areas, and it's farmed in England and Russia, in fact in most of Europe, in marshes otherwise not producing a native mammal. Then you get down to the serenity, the dugongs and manatees, and they're trying to both reserve them to prevent them being hunted because they're in low numbers, and also they found them extremely useful animals for clearing out, keeping irrigation drains flowing and large drain systems. They've been very good browsers. They've had very little success in breeding them. But they're using them in Florida and other areas. So they're a whole other group of animals useful for that purpose. And they are food, but everybody's trying to stop them becoming food because there are so few of them. We have a lot of them up north at present. Dugong, which are marine. So there's and then all the groups of mink and beaver, and they're spreading beaver throughout, re-spreading them throughout the United States, and they've reintroduced into parts of Europe. Not only because of the yields from the beaver, which are, you know, castorum for scents and furs, but because of their very beneficial effect on flood reduction and on general wildlife. They make a marvellous river, beavers. The American Indians say that it was a beaver that made North America. They have this ancestral beaver. And when they got there, there were gigantic beavers, and they made gigantic dams, you know. The beavers are fantastic. I mean, they make tunnels and canals, they tow logs. They're great engineers. They have all sorts of different overflow systems. They talk a lot to each other. In the winter, they make these little lodges up above the water, sitting up in here. And if you put a microphone there, they're talking all winter. I don't know what they're talking about, but it's a very complex sound exchange is going on, so they're probably just working out next winter's dams. Or you know, just planning, sitting there like a lot of guys in the club, really, just planning things, you know. So they've been reintroduced mainly by airdrops throughout. Yeah, they let them down in parachutes. And, you know, the cages of them that open when they hit the water, so you've got 20 beaver swim out. Because they're putting them into very remote areas from which the trappers trapped them out in the old days of the fur trade. So they're gaining ground. It's very much like the wild turkey has been reintroduced to all these old forests in America now. You can still get a wild turkey. They got to the stage where the only turkeys in America had to be hand inseminated. I met a turkey inseminator on a plane once. Sort of looked quite an ordinary looking guy, you know, like you or me. As soon as I said, "What do you do?" He says, "Well," he says, he said, "I'm the father of the turkey on the eastern seaboard." He said, "I do about 40,000 a day." I said, "I won't ask you how you do this." So he said, "Yeah, they can't mate anymore. The breast's so large on the cockerels, and so they're running out of turkeys that could actually breed, and they found a few wild turkeys that could still breed, and they didn't find them in America either. They found, like, we've got a population in Bass Strait Islands, and American turkeys, of course, but they hurriedly gathered up these wild turkeys and got back to a turkey that could still breed. Otherwise, the turkey was totally domesticated and probably headed for extinction, unless these breeders kept going, of course. These guys have sexed them and bred them. Get into all these weirdo foul-ups. Righto. Now, where did I get to the bloody turkeys? Oh, I know. This mammal sort of group around, we have throughout Australia the golden-bellied water rat, who's a great mussel eater and eats a lot of yabbies. And eats eels, a lot of eels. And he was a fur animal for many years, but it doesn't have much other use and not a desirable inhabitant of the ponds. It's not as nice as a beaver or anything. It bites like fury too. I was live trapping and earmarking them once, and I'll never forget this. And I had a couple in the cage, and I'd ear clipped them, and I lifted the cage up, and there was a stream running, and they went down the water, and then one came back right up the cage, and I still had the door open. It was a spring door, and I was looking at this little thing, and I thought he was going to walk back in the cage. He didn't. He walked up the cage and bit my finger. That was pretty strange. He had second thoughts before he went. When he came back and bit me deeply in the finger, and I went, "Hell," you know. And then he walked down to the water. He thought, "I'm not going before I give him one, you know. I'll teach him to catch me." Right. It was a very composed animal, the water rat. You can't panic a water rat. It always looks at you and thinks about it all.
And how do you get rid of them?
Oh, you don't, you know, they're okay. You just can fence them out pretty easily. They can only go over little low fences. And you can put a little electric wire around to stop them coming into ponds. But you could also tolerate a couple of water rats in a pond. Not a lot, though. Not if you're rearing eels. They love their eels, marin. Yeah, they pile them all up. They make a little table like this. And everybody catches what they're going to catch and kills it. And they put it all on the table. Then the whole family sits around the table. And they smack in the little ones and all that. They're great to watch, actually. I mean, one family's all right. Good manners, water rats. Very, very communal. But we don't have a lot of these guys. The other interesting thing are some of the reptiles. They're widely cultured, and particularly the turtles. And as here, we can send off and get our 100 yabbies. So in the United States, you can get your 100 box turtles or snapper turtles. We don't have snapper turtles. They take your fingers off. But they're good to eat, and they're a big a big part of your yield from water, especially the plant-eating turtles. And they're also breeding up, but nobody quite knows where it'll end up, the marine turtles, just to get to increase their numbers. But one of the up-and-coming water animals is the anaconda, whose food conversion efficiency is much higher than chickens. He's got about a 2-to-1 conversion efficiency, and he can really pack the stuff on. You get a 60-pound anaconda in a year, you know, unlike a chicken. And the meat is very highly in demand. The Americans eat quite a bit of reptile meat. They can a lot of snakes, and we've got in this class we've got our crocodiles, which are being farmed here and in New Guinea fairly successfully. Although their conversion rate's not anywhere near the anaconda. Anaconda eats quite a lot of fish too. I noticed in Germany probably the greatest biomass in the Berlin Zoo is actually pythons. They seem to grow best, and they've got bloody tons of pythons in there. I don't know what the growth rate's like, but they look quite good to me. Those big diamond pythons, you know, from up north. When they got hundredweights of them, it's time they started to eat them. Right, they mightn't take that very kindly, although Germans will eat a lot of things, I must admit. So there's particularly the turtles. Now, our long-necked turtle, which is thrown back by fishermen, is a highly regarded food of the Aborigines and of white people who eat them. So the stinker, you know, our long necks, you're always catching them on your lines and netting them. That's apparently quite a choice turtle for turtle soups and all this. If you can got it in your heart to... trouble is when you behead a turtle, he goes on walking for a long time. So it's quite you've got to be quite hard-hearted to sort of go into the turtle trade, I guess. On the other hand, they can make ocarinas out of the shells there, get music out of them. So there's quite a wide range of cultured things. Now, some of the things that are cultured successfully are unexpected, in that one of the most successful commercial cultures is for bait fish. And a lot of people who don't make success at rearing trout make awful good success at rearing bait fish for fishermen, or chum fish, or tiny little fish for white bait. So little fast breeding fish are often more successful in culture than the large spectacular fish. Right, so this is your vertebrate choices. Any comments or questions? And all these groups are cultured somewhere. I was on an island recently working in Fiji where the turtles were, they say tambu, we say taboo. The turtles were tambu. And the lagoon was absolutely carpeted with turtles, green turtles. And there were thousands of them, you know. So they had an arrangement with the turtle god where they didn't interfere with the turtles. And you have a big biomass of turtles which is totally absent on other islands where the turtles are eaten and they're not taboo. And therefore, what we tend to do is to take huge quantities of biomass and therefore turnover out of the systems when you kill all the seals or kill all the turtles. It just isn't there anymore. And when you see it where it is, where there's big colonies of seals and turtles, a fantastic turnover of material, and a lot more things occur because turtles are there and because seals are there. The fishery is much greater where there are seals than where there's no seals. And there's a huge manurial drop if you're swimming in Bass Strait near the seal rookery. There's a huge manurial drop over the seagrasses from the seals, who are eating mainly non-commercial fish. And then you get bulk other fish where seal rookeries are. And they're just absent when the seal goes. So you've got all these interactions. And same with dugongs, no doubt, that it's a wrongful thing to remove species out of systems, or even not to reduce them below efficient turnover levels.
So how do you measure that?
I think what you do is examine the situation where there are seals and the fish yield, which is very high, and examine the situation where the seals are gone and the fish yields are now very low, and say, well, you're bloody silly to say that seals eat fish because you just didn't think the whole thing out. They also produce a lot of fish which you eat, and they eat the fish you don't eat, and generally bring a bit of sense into the situation.
And what about in the pond situation? Say you've got a quarter acre pond.
Oh, in that situation, you don't have a seal.
No, I'm not
concerned. No. Besides, horses don't like it. Horses got the same approach to seals as they got to camels. They hate them, you know. So you always try to stop your horse kicking your seal to death, you know. Had an uncle who used to keep a tame seal. He was fighting horses off all the time, you know. Yeah.
But anyway, how do you rate your harvesting then?
Oh, right, we'll get into that in a minute. We'll get into a whole thing called yields, right, which is really important to us. I've just gone through a little overview of the things grown in water and of their amazing variety, really, and the amazing flexibility of the aquatic system as against the straight-up stuff, the land system, where you've got two-hoofed animals and five species of crop, you know. Yeah, they're mammals. Large rodents, like I think the nutria is about sort of 4 to 5 kilo rodent, the capybara is about a 20, 25 kilo rodent, you know, I mean, capybara is a big animal. Yeah.
They introduced into England.
Nutria.
Yeah, another one called
koi poos. And koi poos, yeah.
And they escape and they run wild in north and south through the
marshlands. Well, throughout Europe they introduced the nutria. Not only in England, throughout Poland, Russia, everywhere.
But they eat venison. Koi poo, you can't tell the difference between koi poo and venison. People won't eat them because they look like rats, but if you serve it up and tell them it's venison, they don't know any difference.
Well, that's it, isn't it? Yeah. Same with wallabies and all that. Yeah, they are, you know, they could, if they want to harvest them, they could wipe them out if they were fairly serious. They just, you know, at the British lot, they've got to keep a few wallaby here and a few koi poo there, and they've got some wild minks and all that. They don't ever wipe them out, they sort of tolerate them, half tolerate them. You do? Oh, well, we could go into... Yeah, that would be good. Very profitable business, farming koi poo in England. Is that all? Well, so we could sell the meat and skin them and, oh, boy. Right, yeah. Yeah, in the Norfolk reed beds in the Broadsea. Mm. Right. Yeah, so there are all those guys out there being farmed somewhere. Mostly where they live, but in a few cases introduced too. Nobody thinks twice of introducing trout, do you notice? Trout is a sacred introduction because they're fished by the privileged classes. It costs you at least $4,000 to get your gear on by the time you've got your split cane rod and your waders and your little hut by the water and so on. And then you pay $150 a day and flick your fly at the water. And so these are... Nobody ever complains about introduction of trout, because they are for a privileged group. Curiously, mainly impotent. Why, I don't know, but trout fishermen. Yeah, I don't know whether too much cold water or standing in cold water or... because they're thinking of something else or what it is. Too much fly tying at night, you know. Some reason we had 46% impotence in trout fishermen. So they're never home anyhow, so nobody notices, right?
So did
the
study on the impotence
for
this trout
fishing? What?
Who did the study on the impotence for this trout fishing?
I did. I was a fisheries biologist with a psych degree. And also with a zoology degree. So I used to study the fishermen as well as the fish. I thought it was quite interesting what makes all these guys fishermen. So they kept coming up to me and talking to me about little problems, and I thought, I'll censor you buggers, you know, I'm doing the fish, I'll do you too, so. It was 46% of them admitted to impotence. There might have been a few a bit shifty about it. Right. Well, you can think of your own reasons for this, I don't know what they are. But it's very much a male occupation too, that trout fishing, that solitary fly fishing, seems to me. Didn't see many ladies doing it. My wife took it up and fished for 10 years and had to get a trout. there's one of my wives, and the other day she got 10 in one day and sent me one up. So she's broken through the impotence barrier there somewhere. Something's happened to her. Right. Now, so, fish. Now, yields. Factors in. Now, we've got to take three things into account. Upstream conditions, downstream conditions, and the pond, to properly assess yields. And you can't properly assess yields unless you look at these. Because whether you've got a still pond or not, you've got some runoff or some water, which is your raw material, and even in a still pond, you still release any runoff in excess of evaporation. And the pond is of the water quality is a very large determinant of yield. Well, upstream in pond cultures, it's desirable to have a high nutrient water, and we can arrange that because we're not passive about it, as simply as putting a pig shed over the stream, which is, you know, general. I mean, it's not a condition of the water, but in all Asian areas, almost. This can be a toilet or a pig pen or a chicken pen, and it's over the water and it's slatted above the water below the roosts in the chicken pens, so that all the manures from land animals are going to water. Now that happens a lot anyhow when you consider the droves of animals that are actually working water. There's a big transmission of nutrient from land to water. There's nothing more spectacular than lying down in a river during the autumn in the northern hemisphere and hanging onto a rock. And all that's approaching you is a continual train of tons of leaves, just thousands of tons of leaves, floating on the water and sinking and being converted. And mangroves are huge. They put down about 4 to 5 tons of nutrient per hectare per season. And that's all really converted into fish. So it's the amount of leaf material and manures entering the water system before you get, or fertiliser is a better word, generally, that is essential nutrients being leached from the land and from the plants, and also being deposited by animals. And an awful lot of birds roost over water. All your cormorants come inland, roost in marshes, gulls always on marsh edges, huge conveyance of phosphates into water by a lot of mobile, and all your insects that end up in water are phosphate rich. So it's a condition of this stream up here is important to the production in here. The condition in the pond is pretty critical. The three or four things is pH. There's nutrient level, which are these are interdependent things, and there's pollution as a factor, and that can be biological as well as chemical pollution, and muddiness, I'll put. Now, these have pluses and minuses. For instance, if you're growing our native perch, the big guy, the Murray cod, He's got to have muddy water. He's a muddy water fish, and our yabbies are muddy water fish. It reduces predation, increases their effectiveness as predators because they're adapted to mud, same with catfish. But for a lot of other fish, muddiness is a limiting factor on yield. Pollution. Well, a fertilizer can become a pollutant if the fish aren't tolerant of high nutrient situations. Now, almost all the fish we culture are. Things like mullet and prawns and most of the things we culture because they're actually reducing the water nutrient. They're very efficient fish at removing nutrient from the waters, particularly two of our mullets, what you call herring, a yellow eyes and that. They're great algae eaters, they're omnivores too. So we culture, mainly we culture fishes which are tolerant, but in some cases, trout, it will not stand high levels of algae and weed, it simply chokes in the water. pH in water should be above that of the land, and generally we like to see a pH of 8 or 7, 5 to 8 in ponds where we tolerate 5.5 to 7.5 in our garden. That's the garden. Pond is just a little higher. Don't like to see ponds below 6.5. Calcium then, we need to add to water calcium. Most ponds are limed. Almost all ponds have a lime input. It's good for bones and growth, and also for, and to some extent, it governs the release of other nutrients and it reduces the amount of metallic pollutants to keep your pH up. So it reduces, if you've got a problem with metals, high metal levels in your upstream water, you need to lime heavily, and that's just as true of tanks as like your own water tanks. You should lime your tanks as it is of ponds. So the quality of water here is got a great influence on yield, and up here too. Then downstream, because this is high quality, this water will double yields on land. So it's much better to irrigate with fish pond water than it is with the water that was coming into the pond. This is a much better irrigation source. And it literally is a doubling of things like tomatoes and bananas and all that. You get twice as many as you will if you're watering from the stream unmodified, as if you then if you have modified this for a high production of fish. It's a much better source of irrigation material. So if you take your yield into account, now I want to look in the pond here. Now, the sort of vast difference is a background yield would be 70 to 100 kilograms of, say, fish, we'll take fish, per annum per hectare. And that would be a base yield. A natural water will give you that of anything. It'll give you 100 kilograms of trout or 100 kilograms of mussels and 100 kilograms of this and that. However, there's probably no upper limit known to us yet that we can't raise that yield. And typically, we can achieve fairly easily 40,000 kilograms per annum per hectare. So there's the difference in managed and unmanaged systems. It's a huge difference. It's factors of hundreds greater. 100 kilograms of biomass that you can take out per year would be typical, say, of an unmanaged farm pond something, or of a lagoon on the coast. That would be a natural system, like a lake in a rock-based lake or something. There's no problem in getting, in fact, you'd expect an order of 3,000 to 4,000 kilograms as an average yield. from a managed pond system. So you need very little amount of well-managed pond to give you... That's why pond fish are going to really have already, in a sense, replace wild-caught fish. Your wild fish are...
If you've got a, say, fairly intensive situation where you're trying to maximise the yield and you need clean water, say, trout, can you effectively use something like watercress or a plum to clean up the woods?
Mm-hmm.
So suspended down the results on it?
Mm-hmm. We're going to deal later with water purification. I've put it up here. And I'll deal with it one thing at a time. And we'll deal with it in relation to trout. Now, what are the inputs into a managed pond that make it so different from the background yield of natural systems? Talk to a limnologist, he'll say this figure would be about the yield we'll take out of an unmanaged system. Now, because some natural systems are very high yielding, you'll get 1,000 kilograms in some high yielding systems. Well, what are the real factors? Okay, so the first thing is definitely nutrients, and that's one. Now, we expect factorial increases of, you know, order of by 10 on addition of key nutrients. And just like the land, one of the real key nutrients is certainly phosphates. So you would look to have an input of the usual phosphate sources, animal manures, seed cake from pressed seeds, you know, very high phosphatic source. So if you're feeding fish or feeding animals upstream on seed cake, then you're going to get a big bump in fish yields. Or if you can, and then insects, another tremendous source of phosphates. That's why a lot of bird manures are so high in phosphates. Fish themselves and marine organisms eaten by cormorants have a high phosphate content. So if we can add this phosphorus, which is fairly rapidly leached, and if we can fix it with mussels, so it's in the pond and constantly recycling, then we bump the yield many times. When you actual figures here for mussels are 76 kilograms unfertilized as against 1700 kilograms fertilized. So there you are, that's about a 20 times factor change by the addition just of phosphate. They're actual figures from real ponds. So there's an enormous difference in yield. And of those 1,700 kilograms, 500 are actual meats. And they get 1,100 kilograms of mussel meats out of well-fertilised prawn ponds. So. Now the other thing is the species mix. You've got major nutrients, you've got some the old NPK stuff, and then you have minor nutrients in ponds too, which are traces of minerals. The species mix in ponds, you've got to have a little bit of copper for your crustacea, though copper is the base of their blood system. Species mix in ponds. Now, you can get a very big increase in yield by adding a few species. And generally, you look for something that works the base of the pond, like mussels and catfish. Forget them, they're down here. They're doing their bit down here. And some midwater fish, like prawns, and something on... And then you must increase, I feel, waterfowl. You must include waterfowl as part of your yield. And there you are, there's a nice 4 or 5 species mix. And that will bring your... Again, up by a factor of 10 or 20 will bring your yields up, because you can select them in terms of guilds. One of the best of the fish culturalists, Old Swindles, who did more work, I think, on basic fish work then, he said that 50% of your pond can be devoted to non-fish or non-prawn area if it contains the food of the fish or the prawns. That is, he said, you can actually double or quadruple the yield of the pond by taking 50% of it and just letting little shrimp breed in there to feed trout. And you get much more trout than you would if you hadn't shut off that half of your pond. And that's something like what we say in agriculture. If 30% of your farm is in windbreak, you'll still get almost double the yield of crop, even though you've devoted 30% to windbreak. It's the same in ponds. If you devote 30 to 50% of your pond to food species for the fish, or conditions for food, and that can be algae, then you'll increase the yield of fish vastly, even though you've actually decreased the productive growing area of the pond. You're growing your food in the pond. I'll show you how to do that later. Several ways to do it. Swindle said what he did there, he did it with all his trials on shrimp. He just filled half the pond with brush bundles in which the little shrimp live, and let the fish move through the other half, and he doubled or quadrupled his fish yields. Even though it actually the fish couldn't get at half the pond, it was in production on their behalf. So species mix, and
was there a water transfer between the two halves?
They're the same water. In that case, they're the same water. I'll show you some other. Yes. No, just brush. He just tied brush in bundles, seeded it in with prawns, and then stocked it with fish at the same stocking density that he did a pond without brush bundles, and got very large increases in yield. Right. So the species mix and the provision of... to make some provision for food in the pond. Now, a lot of people don't do that. Typically, a trout farm or a trout farmer will excavate some holes and concrete them, put straight sides and run water in, feed the fish, and makes no provision whatsoever in pond for fish food. The fish does. Fish have no hand in whether they're fed or not. He tips in the chicken pellets one end, trout come out the other. Because trout are quite a high price, he makes a reasonable profit on them. But if the price per pound of trout or prawns drops, then you have to provide food in the system for the species you're rearing. And fish that are fed, again, have a buy 10 or 20 times where there's food provision. On those that are not, you have this natural background rate. Nobody's feeding these things. They're actually foraging out what food they can in multiple competition with other animals and maybe other plants. Plants are the great carnivores, of course. They eat all animal remains. So if we make specific provision for food for the species that we've selected, we're way ahead again. And then the species mix, the proportion of species. Interestingly enough, you want about one quarter predators. So say you're stocking a little pond with predatory fish and grass eaters and plankton fish, you do quite well to put a quarter of the total count of fish in as a predator of the others. What they do is something interesting. They cull the slow-growing fish of the other species. Now, here comes a bit of a boomer. If you've got a lot of fish in a pond like carp and you net them and only keep the big ones, in 1 year you can quadruple your yield because you've selected for fast growth. And some little things, including trout, never grow. Well, we know trout that get to 7 inches stop and start breeding. And they just never grow above it. And that's a quarter of an inch below the legal size, so they've got their head screwed on. Now, if you're always throwing those back, we've got streams in Tasmania which only have 7-inch trout. And if we dropped the legal limit to 6 1/4 inch, we'd get a 6 1/4 inch breeding trout. or a 6-inch breeding trout. Now, some of our heavily fished crayfish beds have crayfish which grow up to legal size, 4 1/4-inch carapace, turn up their rostrum, so you can't, because we measure from the tip of the rostrum, and half the crayfish, here's the eye, and here's the rostrum from which we measure. Many beds, there's no crayfish without an upturned rostrum, because it allows him to live another 5 years without being killed. It's the same like if we ran electric hot wire across the street at 5'6" and took the tops off all the heads of the above average Australian. Pretty soon you've got a lot of short Australians and you lower your hot wire. Pretty soon you're breeding people like this, because nobody else around to breed, that's it. You know, if you can't stop at 4'2", you're dead. And we've got a whole population of arostral crayfish. And whereas before the natural carapace shape of the cray was this, in some of the heavily fished beds, the things simply widen. They don't grow at all. They go sideways like that. So you get these big, wide arostral crayfish, all dead stop at just 4 3/8". And that only took us about 100 years to do that. Always you've got to throw them back because we're very heavy on that. Isn't it? And it's a result of a mythical idea of conservation, that is, throw the little bastards back. My idea is stamp on the little bastard and let the big ones go. So we should have a totally different concept in fisheries. It's a maximum size concept. You can't take crayfish over a certain size. And then we'd all have fast-growing, healthy populations, and we'd be getting rid of these little pygmoid trout and all these damn fishermen throwing them back. Whenever I'd take them off and hit it on the log, I'd say, don't throw little ones back. So where are we going to get the future fish from? I said, from your big fish. That's the only place you'll get them from. Because a large crayfish has 40,000 eggs, all of which grow fast. A little crayfish has about 1,000 eggs, all of which dwarf along.
Well, why have I chosen that technique?
Because they're idiots. It's a political move, right? It's not a biological move. You've got to make a difference between the real world, which is out there, biological world, and the political world, which is in there, getting votes. It gets votes to throw little ones back. Everybody thinks you're conserving the fishery. I've given this talk and brought in the crayfish carapaces into political meetings. They all agree they should put a maximum size limit on, and they go away and they don't do anything about it because everybody'd say, oh, what a shame, eating all these little crayfish. Where are we going to get the next crayfish from? It's really easy to run a maximum size fishery. It's what every farmer does, doesn't he? He kills all the calves and only keeps the breeding stock, doesn't he? And if he killed all the breeding stock and only kept calves, it would only be the precocious breeding calf that would survive, right?
Yeah, I mean, when you say it now, it seems so damn obvious, it's done.
Yeah, well, that's true. But you also got to modify it, and so it's very sensible in sedentary fisheries, where things are trapped in ponds or where you can get at them like crayfish or abalone, to let the big ones go. Now, in pelagic fisheries, what you're dealing with is age year groups going past, and you might as well take only what you put in there is a proportion of the group. You know, say for tuna, every time you meet a group, no matter what its size, you should take 20% of the total herd or whatever. So that's on take, not on size. But with a sedentary fishery, it should always be a maximum limit to what you can bring ashore. Fast growing. Now that makes a huge difference in ponds. Now so you addition of about 25% generally all over you'll find predators, 250 Murray cod to 1,000 yellow belly, is highly beneficial to the total yield of the pond. The yield goes up because what you do is you remove your stunted and slow growing fish from the other population. Because your Murray cod is the same size or can even be smaller than the yellow belly. And he, as he grows, he's able to eat only yellow bellies left behind in the yield race. Now, for whatever reason, it might be dwarfism is in all animals and in all plants. And so the things may be naturally dwarfed, or they may be ill or something, or they may lack certain nutrients, or they may be bad foragers, or whatever. Same with chickens, you know, you never keep a chook with a sharp beak. She's not a good forager. She's got those old blunt beak chooks, they're the ones that are really making it, you know. We're dealing with. Well, when you net, say you stock a pond with fish, 1,000 fish, and you net it, you'll get a lot of fish which are twice as large as the others. And if you're going to breed your own fish, you take those out and use those for your breeders because they have done well in that pond for any number of reasons. Could be salt tolerance or pH tolerance or forageability. And you can double your yield in 12 months by making that selection, by discarding slow growers. Don't worry your head about why they're not doing well, because there's probably not one reason, there's probably several. What you're interested in is which fish will grow fast in this pond. So it's really an empirical thing. Now, disease is another big factor. So disease-free fish. Now this has resulted in another whole area of aquaculture, which we're doing well at in Tasmania, and it is breeding from known disease-free stocks. The largest export, cash export, of aquacultural products from Tasmania is trout eggs, because we lack a whole sequence of disease, particularly one bad one called red eye, which is throughout the Northern Hemisphere. So that's our biggest cash export out of Tasmania is not the trout, it's the trout eggs. And we send them out in big stainless steel flasks packed in ice and moss. And they've flown all over the world because everybody who wants to rear trout in a new situation has to buy in Tasmanian eggs. And in fact, they've gotten the habit of buying them in annually.